This story is called Cannibals for Dinner. The rain pounded down as if it would never stop, hard enough to make one envision an ark. They were inside their car while rain lashed against the windshield and roof, noise so loud it drowned out conversations. The wind blew them sideways. If one were to open the window, the wind would slap you in the face, a hard slap. The car was hydroplaning. Dinner was at a strip mall at an Afghani restaurant. Ron concentrated on the road and tried to relax his hands as they tightly gripped the wheel. Claire remained quiet, staring intently at the GPS. He liked the fact that the GPS voice was that of a British female. She instructed their every move in crisp tones that did not leave a scintilla of doubt that she knew where she and they were going. Ron glanced at the car's clock, brightly illuminated in the dark. He hated tardiness. He found it to be insulting. There were parts of the world, such as Manhattan, where lateness was an affectation of importance. Here in New Jersey, it was simply rude. Suddenly, the British voice sounded. "You have reached your destination." Claire and Ron looked at each other with a mixture of amusement and consternation. They determined this was the address, but they were in the middle of a residential street. Ron looked up and down the tree-lined, rain-soaked street and asked, "Do you think that there was a wet restaurant here at one time?" "We have to get this thing updated," Claire announced, not for the first time. "I doubt that there was ever a restaurant here." "Then what good would updating the GPS do?" Claire chose, at this point, to be quiet. She knew that his obsessive nature would bring about a side of him that she didn't always like. He would be terse and sarcastic until they reached their destination. Of course, once they did arrive, his personality would quickly change in chameleon-like fashion, and no one would be the wiser to the long car ride and what she had endured. He handed her their shared cell phone. "See if you can get a number for this place," he stated, almost at a command. Inwardly, Claire grimaced, thinking, "Here we go again. I didn't bring my glasses." She knew this response would invoke his instant disapproval, and with a clipped "Okay," he pulled the car over and took the task of dialing information. A sense of relief washed over her, and she let out her breath with a long sigh when he said, "I had the wrong address." She wanted to chide him. If the situation were in reverse, he would have exploded all over her. "April gave me Mountain Avenue, not Boulevard." "Of course," she thought to herself, "it is never your fault." In spite of this, they arrived a mere 5 minutes late. Ron circled the parking lot. He was suspicious about restaurants in strip malls. He wasn't sure why, but it always made him think of food courts and plastic eating utensils. The strip mall, however, had 3 restaurants, Greek, Japanese, and Afghani. Interesting. They walked to the restaurant, careful to keep beneath the overhangs that channeled runoff like the cascading wall of water it was. Everyone was seated when they arrived. The electricity of happy recognition danced in the air between them. The table, empty chairs were at diagonal corners. April had made sure that she was seated next to Claire, who she hadn't seen in a long while. Ron kissed April on the lips, shook hands with her husband, Russ Crenshaw. He then smiled and made eye contact with Russ's Dirk, along with a warm hug from his wife, Sabrina. Claire let the warmth of her feelings show in a smile toward everyone but April. She took April's hands in a warm embrace, their affection clear to anyone who watched them. Claire had been nervous about tonight, about her dinner, about her voice since her illness. She was worried about talking loud enough to be heard and trying to eat simultaneously. That might prove a difficult task. Ron also stood in back of April and said, "We're sorry to be late." To this, April leaned her head back against him and turned her eyes up with a smile, as Russ said, "The 5-minute rule. You're fine." The two of them shared Ron's concern for punctuality. "April, my dear, my sweet, we are just about as late as it takes to get from Mountain Avenue to Mountain Boulevard." "Oops." April blushed and laughed. Dirk, too, laughed while saying, "That's right, there are two." "My mistake," April readily admitted. "I thought I copied it from the website." "Obviously not." Claire watched, as she knew would happen. Ron would turn a minute of sheer hell for her into a table topic of conversation. He recounted the guidance of the GPS, the crisp English affectation of location, and heard them all laughing uproariously. It was a knack he had, from sarcastic to sullen to laughter and lightness, all in 60 seconds. Claire was a patient woman. The ambiance of the room was warm, cozy, and a shelter from the outside rain. Over Ron's head, April watched a large screen computer streaming various scenes of Afghanistan, with no hint of a war-torn country and its refugees and bombed-out caves. Instead, it showed a land where beauty was a privilege of the young. The tables were close together, but not too tightly backed, merely cozy. Russ told the story of how he had previously scouted out the place that was recommended to them by friends. From that scouting and a study of the menu, he thought it was worth a try. Ron peered at the menu. The light was dim enough to make it difficult. While he was trying to make out words, Russ, directly across from him, started a conversation. "You talked about science fiction the last time we saw you. Who would you say is your favorite author?" "Harlan Ellison," responded Ron without thought. Russ grinned in agreement. "Mine as well." Suddenly, Ron felt out of his depth, unusual for him on a topic of literature. He truly liked Harlan Ellison and read Dangerous Visions and its sequel, but he hadn't remembered if it had touched him deeply enough to remember anything. Not in the way Gene Roddenberry or Ray Bradbury did. He didn't have a working knowledge of Ellison's vast body of work, and vaguely recalled Ellison had been an editor of a book containing stories of other authors in the genre. Ron was oblivious to the staggering number of works that Russ quoted. He tried to recover, but Russ understood. He was a single step above a name drop. While still listening to Russ, Ron realized that he could only partially make out the menu. He watched Claire remove her glasses from her bag and with no difficulty at all peruse the menu. He cast a sympathetic glance in her direction until he realized it wasn't necessary. The waiter was now at the table, people ordering food. Russ took over the ordering of appetizers for the table, and still, Ron could barely read the menu. Was it the light? The small print? His eyes? What? Then he heard April order tilapia. And since he had a preference for fish, he ordered the same. When asked what rice he wanted with it, he was again confronted with a vision problem. This time, Sabrina came to his rescue. Leaning in from his right, she said, "Here are the choices for rice." To him, Sabrina felt like romantic energy without romance. He followed her finger, pointed at the menu, and said, "Saffron, please." He was glad that was over. Dirk had ordered first and noted that he liked the menu. Russ was having black Angus, Sabrina wanted pork, and Claire ate lamb with orange rice. Everyone had a laugh at April's expense when the huge salad she had ordered with her tilapia was huge. It was funny to those who knew of April's lack of interest in food and generally meager appetite. Everyone had a glass of champagne to belatedly toast Dirk's birthday celebration that had been postponed due to Hurricane Sandy. Now long past his birthday, Ron and Claire had become post-storm's addition to the guest list. As the appetizers were arriving at the table, Ron said, looking at April and then the rest of the table, "I want to write an essay on oral sex." Claire inwardly cringed, knowing that there wasn't anything Ron wouldn't say. He had no boundaries. April blurted out, "Talk to Sabrina." When April said this, Ron noticed that Dirk was so still that he was practically in a meditative state. Sabrina was squeezable ripeness. She almost involuntarily exuded fertility. Ron gave her a sidelong glance and saw that she wasn't embarrassed. She wasn't blushing. Her white teeth and ripe lips were just to his right. He snapped his gaze back to Russ, who was saying, "I know what you mean. You want to write about the ways that people talk about it." Ron felt the warmth of understanding that can only come from a friend, someone who gets you, or at least parts of you. "I'll wind up having to read more Victorian literature than I'm willing to do ever. I can't see George Sand in my future. The Mill on the Floss? So, maybe not. Perhaps it's best expressed in grunts and groans anyway." "I love George Sand," said April defiantly. At the same time, Claire thought to herself, he just couldn't or wouldn't stop. He always needed the grunts and the groans. They were a necessity. There was always the next step. He was foolish enough to try to tell her that he was not manipulative. She knew better. She knew what he was doing. It was what he always did. He had to erase the lines of acceptable discourse. He did it on purpose. He knew it, and she knew it. Ron sensed Sabrina listening intently as Claire and April spoke together softly. Dirk was silent, while Russ and Ron continued their conversation about science fiction. "I think Ellison wrote a bunch of Twilight Zone pieces, didn't he?" said Ron, glad to now to have recovered more information about Ellison as the conversation progressed. "Yes, he absolutely did," said Russ with a nod of approval. He, too, felt that here he had found someone who understood him as well, or pieces of him. All was good. Emotionally, Ron thought, Bradbury had been his favorite sci-fi author, Martian Chronicles. He cursed himself for choosing the more hip Ellison. Leftovers from the bullshit personality of Dr. Tuck, he thought. His taste in science fiction was pedestrian. He should just admit it and move on. While thinking this to himself, his ears were still tuned to Claire and April across the table, still whispering, but the whispers had grown louder. Ron responded to their conversation at this point by announcing to the table, "These two over there are discussing my birthday." At this announcement, Claire and April looked like two co-conspirators caught and flushed. Dirk grinned as he munched one of the appetizers, and Sabrina smiled. It seemed everyone had suddenly joined in the conspiracy of Ron's birthday. In order to divert the attention from their conversation and the humongous salad that she had inadvertently ordered, April looked over at Ron and said, "Where have you been that you were so tan?" Russ, too, easily diverted, agreed and added, "Your face is quite red." "I've been working outside, spreading gravel around the driveway." There was a pause before he added, for veracity and effect, 4 tons of it. Dirk laughed while Russ asked, "They didn't do that for you?" As if it was unthinkable. "They left it in a few piles," said Ron. When April had succeeded in changing the focus of the conversation from she and Claire back to Ron, Claire whispered, "It's those teacher's ears." This was to warn her off of the conversation until a later time. So they all turned back to Ron, who continued his story about dirt and gravel and said, "I like to dig." April grinned when he said this and thought, "Oh, you so do." Sabrina gazed at Ron's face, searching for the color that April had first mentioned, while Dirk continued with his chicken. He then added, "I just hear things." He gave her a huge, dimpled smile. The tilapia arrived perfectly fried in a sweet, crumbly crust. The inside was white and succulent. While dipping the fish in the sauce, he said, "This thing about cannibals is interesting." It was a theme in Cloud Atlas and the Hannibal TV series. I wonder why people have become fascinated with it. What about the German man who advertised to have someone who was willing to come to his house and be eaten? April asked. Russ speared a chunk of beef. Claire nodded to April. "What guy?" said Ron. "Arwin Mawis was his name. He placed an ad for someone who would be willing to submit to being eaten, to help consume himself," she responded. "And people answered the ad?" said Claire, who had obviously heard the story. "So, a man from Berlin came to his home," April continued. "They sat down to dinner. They cut off his penis and then ate it together." "Did they cook it?" said Ron. "Sauteed," replied April. "I hope with onions," added Claire. Ron's face formed an exaggerated O. "Claire," he said with mock outrage, "with onions was a necessary addition to the story? Let's bring Iron Chef America to cannibalism." He said this as he pictured the set of the show. The Nibble chairman had summoned a challenger to face Iron Chef Hannibal Lecter. It was Claire. The chairman announced, "Today's secret ingredient, the theme on which our chefs must prepare their succulent variations, is..." Here, another of Ron's dramatic poises, the chairman lifted his outstretched hands as the lid was raised on the dais. "Penis!" There were an array of cocks, varying in size, age, and ethnic coloration, circumcised and with foreskins. Ron looked at Claire in amazement, as if to say, "And you think I push boundaries?" April continued with the Armin story. At first, they tried to try him for assisted suicide. Even the Germans don't appear to have a law against cannibalism. But the outcry was so great that they tried him again for murder and gave him life in prison, all for culinary sexual pleasure. Dirk, who found most people boring, was laughing. He never found this group boring, even if it did contain his father. Sabrina took things in, but never really seemed to react much in one way or the other. While they were still laughing and joking about cannibalism, Ron slipped out for a cigarette. He didn't mind these little breaks that the laws regarding smoking afforded him. It gave him a chance to reflect. He could pop out of the room and then parachute back in. The rain was endless and torrential. There was a fountain in the middle of the courtyard, and it was running and overflowing. Ron's eyes flitted from the fountain to the sheets of water coming down from the overhead. He needed to urinate. Making his way back through the room, he found the sign for restrooms without having to ask anyone. It was an unusual setup. The men's room door was locked. He was standing in what was a work storage supply area. The back delivery door was open. The rain continued to pound the pavement. Ron shifted from one foot to foot, a dance of desperation. The women's room door was half open. It was empty. Ron considered, maybe. Right then, two women came through the door, and he was sure they eyed him with suspicion. The bathrooms were one-seaters, leaving one already suspicious woman in the hall, waiting with him. The younger of the two convinced her partner that she could wait. Ron imagined the looks of disgust that would have been on their faces if he had followed his inclination to use the women's restroom. He could imagine them calling the manager, declaring him a pervert lacking any sense of social graces. Ron kept his back to the waiting woman and stared out at the rain. The older woman slipped out, and the younger one took her place, a revolving door. Finally, the men's room door opened, and one of the employees came out smiling. Ron was greeted with an odor that staggered him. He was almost overcome, but finally, relief. Returning to the table, the conversation bounced like a rubber ball with a desire for a volley. It was convivial. The six of them basked proudly in their unconventionality. The arrangement for paying had been agreed to between Russ and Claire. They would pay one-third of the bill, to Russ and April's two-thirds. Easy enough. Ron had brought extra cash to facilitate the exchange and was about to slip $70 to Russ when the check arrived. That was before Russ started explaining in great detail to the waitress how they wanted to split the bill. Fractions were beyond the young girl. She was dressed in traditional garb and had a sweet round face and a cheerful smile that at this point seemed vacuous. Patiently, Russ again tried to explain the bill to her when another employee appeared over the girl's shoulder and a third explanation was repeated. Finally, there appeared to be an understanding. Ron decided that he might as well use plastic, Claire's preferred way of dealing with such transactions. The residual benefit, she told him, and in that, she was right. The waitstaff returned with two bills. Ron and Russ casually slid their cards out of their wallets, as men are prone to do, but then had to scan the bills to see which belonged to whom. The light was no better on the bill than it had been on the menu. but Ron found his. He added a tip and signed off. However, when the cards were placed back on the tray, the girl fumbled and couldn't tell which one of his and which one belonged to Russ. With that, Ron quipped, "We have pulled this off smoothly and without calling attention to ourselves." Everyone laughed, while Russ replied, "I have no shame. When you've had to lie in the hospital with tubes in your bowels and a bag of brown gunk collected in back of you, and your wife walks in and says, 'Ooh,' you lose any sense of dignity." "Well, on that high note, as always," April responded as she stood to wave. They all followed out, quick kisses all around, hugs and promises to talk soon. Then the night ended with a mad dash through the rain to their respective cars. "Good night," they all said as they ran. As they drove home, Ron asked of Claire, "Did you have fun?" "Yes," she said. "Food was only mediocre, though." "You know," Ron said, "we may have missed April's birthday. I saw on Facebook that someone wished her a happy birthday last Wednesday. I was sure her birthday was the 11th or 12th of June." This concerned Claire. "That would really be a shame." "I don't want that. We have to check when we get home." Emailing when they got home on both sides seemed to have become their ritual. April sent off a note to Claire, telling her how good it was to see them. Claire emailed the next day and found out that her birthday was on the 11th, as Ron thought. April told her that it was her custom to stay in bed on the day of her birthday, sleep through the day, and wake up the next day if it hadn't happened. "It's my small way of cheating Father Time, even though it doesn't work," she wrote. Claire understood, but would have none of it. "Since we were away for so long, between the cruise and then coming home sick, we've really missed you guys. Maybe we'd get together the day before and have your non-birthday celebration without ruining your ritual." So it was agreed. Pizza and drinks for the non-birthday. These plans were altered quickly when April was unable to get anyone to come and stay with her mother. April's mother was 95 and was growing more and more infirm with each passing day. Also, an old friend of April's was in town visiting his mother, and she wanted Dan, a trauma surgeon, to meet Ron and Claire. Dirk and Sabrina said they wanted to join the non-birthday festivities as well. And so it was set for the Crenshaw's house on Monday night. Again, it rained. Ron was beginning to think they were trapped on the set of the film Seven, where it always seemed to be raining. The Tucks lived an hour away. They were on a lake in rural Sussex County, while the Crenshaws had renovated an old home in one of the better sections of a battered city in western Union County. This time, Claire drove. Ron was a miserable passenger. He braked when she braked, cast sidelong glances at the speedometer, and sometimes grabbed for the overhead handle, as if hanging on for dear life, when she approached a curve in the road. Claire attempted to ignore him, but the weight of his overbearing nature was palpable and caused her to say, "I don't like to drive when you are in the car." She did have a heavy foot, but why couldn't he just let something go? She'd made the mistake once of telling him about one of her relatives from Italy who had been a Grand Prix racer. This was all that Ron needed. He made up nicknames for everything anyway. So, when they were in the car, he referred to her as Parnelli Claire. At times, she found him funny and had to laugh. Other times, his incessant teasing was annoying. Claire got her revenge by getting into the right lane and following the slowest driver. This drove Ron crazy, and she knew it. He was not a speed demon, but he was a lane changer. Claire was not. She didn't have the confidence in her ability to use the mirrors that Ron did. He hated traffic with a passion that bordered on road rage. They were now 2 miles from the exit, and she plodded along in the right lane behind an elderly man with his blinker on. Cars sped past on their left. She smiled to herself, greatly satisfied.